It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here, WSB Radio. Wes Moss, your host every Sunday morning. I want to go right back to an important call with Greg. Greg, are you still with us?
Brad? Yes, I'm here.
So, okay, good. So, because this is a really important distinction between the two items that you were referencing. You said, hey, I'm thinking about doing an index fund inside my retirement account. But then as we talked a little bit further, it sounds like an index annuity. So I'm suspecting, first of all, that your 401k is now rolled into, or you have it in some sort of IRA, and now you can kind of buy or invest however you would like. Is that accurate?
Well, it's still a traditional 401k, the way I understand it, with investments in small caps and large caps, and both domestic and international. It's been, you know, a number of American funds, some other funds are included in that. That's the way I understand it. And I've just been keeping it in that fund over the years just to invest. And now I'm wanting to say, if the market shifts and we have a dramatic change in market, what is the most least avoidance I can put it into to ensure that those funds remain intact, or at least a good portion of those funds?
Got it. So you're really looking for safety. Now, you Correct. Have referenced, though, an index annuity. And so is this an index annuity where you have kind of a floor where it's supposed not to ever lose money, but you could get some sort of upside depending on the market? Is that the kind
that
of index annuity we're talking about?
That is correct. Zero risk on loss, and the up potential is I guess capped with about a 5.15% possibility of increase over a 7-year contract period. But the risk is minimal because your investment would stay intact primarily.
So you have to. So you really do commit to this, like a normal. It sounds like a normal index annuity where you put money in, and the catch to some extent is that you really have to leave it there for at least 7 years. If you don't, you get a big penalty. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Got it. Okay. So this is an index annuity, not an index. This is not an index mutual fund, and they couldn't be any more different. So an index annuity, in my opinion, these are actually pretty complicated. They're complicated insurance products. Now, technically, anything you put money into is an investment, but it's technically an insurance product, not an investment. But you're putting your own money into it, so let's call it an investment. It's really an insurance contract or an insurance product, and the way I look at these things is that they're issued by these big insurance companies, and they're really rigged against you. You know, a fixed annuity has this really a floating rate of return. They can say you're not going to lose money in it, or your downside is zero. But again, there's a little bit of a smoke and mirror going on there, because the catch is you have to leave it in there at least for 7 years, or else you get a penalty, and you do in fact lose money if you don't follow their rules. So that to me is the first thing about these. It's a little bit misleading, or maybe a lot misleading. The second part here, Greg, is that they propagate that you could get, you know, zero downside, but oh well, around 5%. Well, that's so in your head you think, well, I'll take that bet, right? Give me about, I can probably get 5, but I have no chance of losing. What's really misleading there, and that it's tied to the market, and you get a portion of what the market does. The S&P 500 goes up 15%. Well, you get a portion of that, around 5. That to me is really misleading, because from what I've seen over many years, 20 years looking at these index annuities that are tied to the S&P, they're tied to the NASDAQ, they, from what I've seen, never do more than around 1.5 to 2% a year. That's what happens in real life. There's the potential, what it could do on paper if everything went perfectly and their formulas lined up, but they're not tied, or they're not pulling in your market gain in how the market actually gains, meaning that an index annuity will say, well, if the market goes up 10% a year, you could get 5, provided that the market goes up an exact 0.5% per month, we'll let you capture that per month. So the formula is rigged against you from actually making that 5%. In theory, it could happen, but historically, it is set up mathematically to capture a market gain in a market environment that never exists.
I see.
So if the market just climbed steadily like a CD and it went up 0.5% clip every month, then those formulas would work, but that's not how the market works. The market goes up 10, down 10, up 3, down 7, and an index annuity doesn't really capture the gains in a roller coaster environment. And quite frankly, even though with the market, ironically, we're just talking about how flat it was this past week, over the course of a month and a year, the market doesn't do it like that, doesn't work that way. So it's a little misleading. The other issue I have with an indexed annuity is investors typically look at these things as, well, I can put 100,000 or 200 or 500,000 in this because it's really safe and this is my safe money. But if when you do that, the other problem is that you're putting money into what I would equate to kind of one bond. I mean, if I'm going to buy bonds, would I want to put, and I had $100,000, would I want to put it in just one bond? So meaning that the credit that you are assuming will back your investment is that one company. That's the difference with an index annuity, is that you when you're buying into that product, who's promising it? Where's the quote guarantee coming from? The guarantee is coming from a company. And in my opinion, if you're going to ever, as an investor, you've got to spread out your risk in case something happens to that one company. It, very different than putting that money into a treasury bond and knowing that what's the backing. Well, the backing is the U.S. government. That's as close to a real guarantee as we can get. Not when a big company says, oh, I guarantee you this thing will work out, because what happens if the company goes under, then you're in real problem. So what I would do, and I've sat here and I've kind of run down these index annuities in concept, because I think they're misleading investments. They handcuff you. I think of it very much like putting yourself in jail so you don't get exposed to the outside world, so you never get hurt. The reality here is that over a course of 7 or 10 years, like a lot of these annuities have surrender penalties on your principal amount over long periods of time, that almost any investment you ever do over that long a period of time, if you really are disciplined to sit there, and the penalty sometimes forces you to do that, almost any asset class over any period of time is going to at least go up by 1% or 2% per year. Even the terrible lost decade in stocks that started in the March of 2000, or I talked about this last week on Money Matters, started, let's say, in 1998 to 2008, even though the Dow went from 9,000 to 9,000, that roller coaster ride effectively was ended up at the exact same point it started at, 9,000 in 98 to 9,000 in 2009, that you still made 2.5% a year because you had dividends every single year reinvested. So even the worst decade ever in stocks still made 2.5% a year. So it's interesting that these annuities are sold on the pretense that you're going to get all this quote market upside that never really happens, for not a lot of for the protection of zero. What I would rather see you do, Greg, is find an option within that 401k or an IRA, wherever these funds are going, that is just that. It actually is treasury bonds. It actually is something that is a diversified, high quality bond product. If you're really looking just for safety and maybe at 1% to 3% upside, that is getting invested in treasury bonds that have real safety and a real guarantee behind them in principle, as opposed to betting the farm on some sort of annuity. 404-872-0750. You're listening to Money Matters right here, WSB Radio. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here every Sunday morning. If you'd like to find me, the Money Matters team, easy to do so. Our team at wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. If you have questions throughout the week or want to contact me and the team with a scenario or a financial situation you're kind of going through and you're wondering really what you should be doing for the next 5 years and the next 10 years, and you want to get our objective advice on that or opinion, we're happy to do that. And we do that every single day. So you can find the contact button in the upper right-hand side at wesmoss.com. StockBridge.com. We're going to go to Stan, who joins us in Stockbridge. Stan, what's going on? How can I help?
I'm 59 years old. I'm going to retire in about 3 years. And I have the choice when my company offers a pension. And one of the choices they give you is take the lump sum or the annuity. And I was wondering to get your perspective on that because the reviews are mixed from what I gather. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, got it. This is multivariable of a decision or financial situation that you can really find, I think, because they both have their merits, right? And I typically start, and again, what Will's asking about, or what Stan is asking about here, is do you take a monthly amount that starts in, let's call it, you said you're 59, Stan, right?
Yeah.
And in this would start at 59 or at 62?
62. That's when I retire, yeah.
So 62, a payment monthly for life, or a big chunk of money that would go into an IRA. Yeah. You'd roll the lump sum in an IRA without, and then you wouldn't get a payment, but you'd have to create your own payment. Which one is more valuable?
Also includes my wife. She would also be the beneficiary if I passed earlier than her. So it goes on for, she's included.
Got it. So that's called a 100% joint survivor annuity payout. And that's the 15%, or that's the $1,500 a month, correct?
Right.
All right. So here's how I start this calculation. How do we decide between the payment, the lump sum, the big chunk of money versus, hey, let's spread this thing out as a guaranteed amount forever? Someone's backing up. Be careful. I don't know if you heard that in the background. So the $1,500 Stan times 12 is $18,000 a year, right? So it's $18,000 is what you'd be getting. And I divide that by the lump sum amount, which is how much?
It's about 230, 240.
Let's call it 200. Yeah, let's call it 235,000. So if you did 235,000, you would if you took that lump sum amount, 235,000, you would have to get, in order to generate $18,000 a month, or I'm sorry, $18,000 a year, or $1,500 a month, you would have to get a 7.65% rate of return every single year to do that, which is hard to get. That's to have a guarantee of 7.8% a year, that's a tough number to get. And the reason, and I do this math to find that benchmark. So I call it the 6% test. And I've written about this on ClarkHoward.com and get a lot of variations on this question. And in your particular case, and the great part about that number is that it's covering you and your wife. So if you took this as what's called a life annuity and it's just on you, that $1,500 a month would probably be $1,700 or $1,800 a month, which would be an 8 or 9% guaranteed rate of return relative to the lump sum. So if in really just looking at the math, provided you have other investments that are liquid, and this is just a piece of retirement, I think. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. It's Sunday morning, 404-872-0750. The number here in the studio, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We're going to continue to go to the phones. Joe joins us from Conyers. Hey, Joe, what's going on? How can I help?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Yes, sir. I got, like I said, about $500,000 in a savings account, just drawing no interest at all, like 0.00 of nothing. But I was wondering where I could put it to draw, at least 1 or 2%. I've got some money in a Goldman Sachs that gets like 1.05, which.
Oh, do you have a Goldman? When you say Goldman Sachs, are you talking about a Goldman Sachs CD?
No, sir. Just this. I don't know what you call it. It's just sitting in their bank account. It's a savings account, I guess. I don't know what it is.
Joe, you've got this period of time where when the Fed had rates at zero, now they're high, a little higher than that. Money markets effectively did pay zero. Today, as the Fed's raised their target rate, then now money markets, you're going to get closer to 1%. It's not that hard to find that. Again, you're going to find CDs 1.5%. You can even get to 2% on CDs, particularly if you go out a couple of years. So if you do a five-year CD, you're looking at 2% or even maybe a little bit more than that. So no reason to not be making at least 2%. 10-year government bond pays over 2%. So there's a lot of really safe options out there where you should be getting at least a little bit of interest, right?
Okay.
So start asking you, whoever, wherever you are, start asking about, let's step things up from a zero rate to at least a 2, maybe a 2.25 rate. And and then beyond that is you're talking about being a stock-oriented investor where you have a portion of your money in equities or stocks that pay some sort of dividend. Again, you can find 3%, 4% dividends from high quality companies. Now, granted, you're going to have principal that'll fluctuate. It doesn't mean a dividend paying stock is very different than a bond. The value can go up and down tremendously. But typically, and more often than not, the dividend rate or level stays extremely consistent. And if you're looking at utility companies or telecom companies, or even some big energy companies, you can find 2.5%, 3%, 3.5%, 4% a year just in dividends. So those are some of the other areas I'd look at as you start to kind of step up money just sitting there in cash, not working for you at all. Stay tuned. More Money Matters straight ahead right here. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. We're going to take your calls and your questions. 404-872-0750, the number here in the studio. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Jeff joins us on the line. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. What's going on?
Yeah, hey there. So, Wes, I've listened to your show, you know, every so often. I really enjoy it. I feel like I've been doing the right things, you know, saving over the years. And, you know, I've amassed over, you know, like literally $1.3 million in, like, IRAs, and I feel pretty good about that. But on the flip side, you know, you're always talking about investing and what to do with the money. But what happens now? I just faced a job loss, a, you know, a consolidation. So I'm looking at, you know, what do I do on those, what suggestions you might have on when life turns on you, right? And I might have to access maybe IRA funds or whatever. I just want to see if you have any general suggestions or things to think about.
Got it. And so let me ask you this. So you're, again, how old are you, Jeff?
52.
So 52, and you've saved, let's call it over $1 million, and almost all of that money is 401k IRA?
It's probably 100k outside. But
got
yeah, 1.3. Yeah, you know, you always think about retiring one day, right?
Right.
And I always hear about your 4% rule, things like that, right? So I just want to see if you have any general comments when.
Yeah, I think there
happens to people.
Yeah, there's a couple of really important pieces of the equation here. Is that that's a lot of money, right? So you've got plenty of money and probably ahead of schedule for your age. If you're looking to retire at a 65, let's call that normal retirement ages to young. To even sooner. So retiring, anything under 66 to me is early. You get into your lower 60s, I think that's very early. And then you go into your 50s, which I've had lots of folks over the years now come to me at 55 and say, Wes, I'm ready. I've hit the benchmarks. I'm ready to go. Then you're in super early retirement and it poses its own set of variables. And you're potentially in that category because technically you're not allowed to touch your IRA money until you're 59 and a half, right? So you've got, according to the rules of access, you got like another 7 years to get until you can even get to the 401k money without paying a big penalty. So you get into a scenario where there are a couple of thoughts. Number one, if you really need to access the money, there are some ways to get to this. Now, you're still even too young for the age 55 rule. So for 55 and your money's in a 401k, then relatively new, not brand new, but relatively new ERISA rules will allow you to get to your 401k money at age 55 if you leave employment at that particular company at 55. You have to have turned 55 And if you leave it in the 401k, not an IRA, 401k, you can access that money without a penalty. However, you're still even too young for that rule. So there's another rule. It's the rule of substantially equal payments. The rule of we call it the substantially equal payment rule. You're allowed to get access your money in before age 59. However, you've got to do it on a schedule and stick to that schedule. And if you break that schedule, it gets disallowed, and then you do end up having to pay taxes. Do you think, so you're only 52, Jeff, do you think you'll be able to find something in the next 6 months to a year work-wise, or do you think it's going to be tough to do that?
No, I definitely believe I will, but, I also wanted to see, what other options there might be, right? And so I've heard of, like you said, how do you avoid potentially not paying the 10% on an IRA withdrawals? And I think I heard, what you were mentioning previously. I wanted to understand a little bit more how that works.
Right. So again, you can do that. I would say the only way the rule allows you from a exemption perspective, you can access the IRA before 60, but you've got to be able to, you have to take that money out every single year. So if you were to look at a guide, the way the math works, you have to take around 4% out. So on, let's say, $1 million, you'd have to pull $40,000 out of that IRA and do that every single year until you get to that age where the 59 and a half year age, or 5 years, whichever is longer. So in this case, you'd have to do it for 7 years. So you'd really drain your IRA if you did that. So I think you're too early to do that. Usually when I see this rule work, if you're 55, 56, and you're getting in, let's say you're closer to retirement, you're almost too young to even mess with that rule. So what I would say, first of all, I would just try to figure out when you think you're going to go back to work. I mean, even if you've got, if it's going to take a year to get another job with similar pay, I think you're almost better off using some of that after-tax money, right? That $100,000 that's not in an IRA, that's what you're going to have to live on for now. You could always replenish that at another point, Jeff. So you could always, when you get a new job, because you've drained that after-tax money, you could always replenish it by not saving as much for a couple of years in the 401k. We're going to go right back to the phones here. Sharon joins us from Atlanta. Sharon, good morning. What's going on? How can I help?
I've recently gotten one of those severance packages from my company, and I'm 59 and a half. So my husband is 63 and thinking about retiring in the next 6 months. So I was a little curious about being able to, I have $30,000 in an IRA with that company at the moment. So am I understanding correctly that I can take that money out, have to pay taxes, but no penalty?
It sounds like that. If you are already 59 and a half, correct. You've got full access now to your 401k money or your IRA without having to pay any sort of penalty. So it's free and clear. Now you're going to have to pay ordinary income tax when you pull money out, but it sounds like if you're already 59 and a half, you're definitely past the penalty phase. Let me ask you this. Did you say, what is it in though? Is it in company stock or mutual funds?
It's company.
Company stock?
Yeah.
Okay. And have you held it for a long time, or is it only recently that you have the stock?
It's only this $30,000 is only what I've done through the company 401k.
But over a couple of years. Okay, so it's been, there's an interesting rule. It's called the rule of net unrealized appreciation. That is there's a nuance. If you have actual company stock, and there are $400 billion plus of individuals that own their own company stock inside a 401k, and the rules can be a little bit different for actual company stock. The bottom line is this. If you're 59 and a half, Sharon, you can access that money whenever you, when you need it. You don't have to start taking it until you're 70 and a half. That's when you have to do required minimum distributions. When you pull money out of a 401k, 90% of the time, you're just dealing with ordinary income. You pull out 10 grand from the 401k, or if you roll it into an IRA, there's no taxes to get it into an IRA. But when you pull it out of a retirement account, IRA or 401k, you can just pay ordinary income taxes. Now, you don't have to pay FICA anymore, and the your tax rate in retirement will probably be lower than when you're working, but you're just gonna, it's gonna be $10,000 worth of income, and it adds to whatever your other income sources are. The one nuance, if you have company stock, you can look at it a slightly different way. The rule of net unrealized appreciation allows you to take the basis, the what you paid for the stock effectively, and pay ordinary income on that basis. But when you sell the stock, if you've pulled this out of an IRA, you pay long-term capital gain on what you made on the stock. So if you're somebody that had, you put $10,000 into your company stock, and this might not be your case because it sounds like it's only been a few years, but let's say you've been with IBM or AT&T for 30 years and you have stock at a $20 basis and today it's worth $100. Then it may be advantageous to look at it and say, well, I'll pay ordinary income on the basis of my stock at $20, and I'll pull the stock out and then just pay long-term capital gain when I sell the stock on that $80 gain. That's using this rule of net unrealized appreciation, or the NUA rule, which really only applies to somebody that has their own company stock inside a 401k plan. Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Susie joins us from Kennesaw. Susie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you this morning?
Good. Good morning. So you have, tell me your question. We don't have a lot of time, so hopefully I can help.
All right. Thank you. I'll make it quick. I had a 401k account that I left a company and I went with another one and I rolled it over to like a custodial type IRA account with this brokerage firm that I'm with. Mm-hmm. And my question is, now that I have a 401k again, would it be smart to roll it into my self-directed IRA that's the custodial account, move that over into the 401k, because then I would have an ability to borrow the money for a down payment for a home as opposed to withdrawing and having to pay tax on it?
Got it. So you were at an employer, you had a 401k, you rolled into an IRA, and now you're with another employer that has a 401k. And because we can't access our 401k, how old are you, by the way, Susie?
62.
Okay, so you could access your IRA money, but you're still going to pay taxes in order to do so, to if you wanted to use it for a down payment on a house. But
right.
Yeah, so you're thinking, well, wait a minute, I'm going to take my regular brokerage money, not brokerage, regular self-directed IRA, and then just get it into the 401k. And then it's under the 401k rules, which are a little different. And in your case, you should be able to take a loan from the 401k and use that as a down payment.
Right.
How do you think you're going to be working for a fair amount of years and be able to have some time to pay that money back?
Well, that's a good question, because I mean, I am going to be working probably. I'm going to try to work till I'm 70. But you know, who knows? I'm in good health, but who knows what'll happen? But that's the plan.
How big of a down payment are we talking about? How much would you like to take out of it in order to use for down payment?
I would like to take about $40,000 out.
Got it. So you're right. It would be nice to not have to pay taxes. If you're already working, you're already a pretty high tax bracket, then you pull another $40,000 out of your IRA, now you're in a really high tax bracket and a big chunk of that gets taken away.
Yeah.
But then you don't want to do it unless you're going to have time at the employer to systematically pay it back. And
okay.
So it is a really good idea to do that. That way you avoid your increasing your taxes too much. I would probably lean towards the 401k roll the IRA back into the 401k and take the loan. Or it's not an all or nothing proposition. Remember that, Susie. You could take a portion of that IRA, roll a big chunk of the IRA back into a 401k, and then you could distribute. Let's say you leave $20,000 in the IRA and just distribute $20,000, so you only increase your adjusted gross income by $20,000. So you don't have to think of it as an all or nothing proposition.
Right.
But I do like the fact that you're going to be able to utilize the 401k rules to take a loan to reduce how much you're going to increase your adjusted gross income. Susie, thanks for the call. Have a wonderful rest of the Sunday. News 95.5 AM 750 WSB. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. I want to go back to the phones here for just a second. As we wrap up Money Matters today, we're headed to Danny, who joins us from Buford. Danny, good morning. We just got a couple minutes left. What's going on?
Yes, Wes, I listen to you pretty much every Sunday, and all I hear is the people with million, 2 million, 3 million. I'm 75 years old. I've been retired 20 years. I got about $350,000 in savings, stock, bonds, and stuff like that. And I have not had a problem in 20 years.
Okay,
I own my house free and clear. When I retired at 55. And you can do it if you do it right.
Wow. And obviously you have Social Security. You have a pension too?
I have a small pension, less than $500 a month.
Wow. Okay. But the house is paid for, Danny.
The house was paid for when I retired.
There it is. So you're right. And I feel like we take calls, Danny, and this is such a wonderful call because it's in context to what we just talked about, where we get calls from kids that are starting out in their 20s and have zero money. We get folks that will call in with $5 million and then everywhere in between. And I think the great point that Danny is making is that you don't need $3 million. You should be very comfortable at that case. I told a story about a couple in California that needed $50,000 or $500,000 a year or $40,000 a month. That's obviously, you're going to need more than $350,000. But to Danny's point, you get the house paid off, Social Security, a little bit of pension. And if you're just generating or taking 3-4% from whatever your nest egg is, it can last forever. Danny was 55. He's been retired for 20 years. And to his point, never had a problem. And by the way, we've had a lot of ups and downs in that 20 years in the market. Danny, we got to run, wrap up Money Matters. But listen, man, thank you so much for the call. And thanks for listening to Money Matters.
Okay, thank you.
Enjoy the rest of this wonderful Sunday. Stay tuned to the best programming on the planet right here. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.